You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research shows that the overwhelming majority of Americans don't follow politics all that closely. And they've got a pretty different view of which issues are most important compared to those who do pay close attention. We'll take a look at the findings and what they say about solving the country's problems. Now, a partial recount of Wisconsin's election ballots began today. The Trump campaign requested and paid for recounts in Dane and Milwaukee counties, states where Joe Biden won a large majority of the votes and where many voters took advantage of the opportunity to vote early and by mail. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you vote early or by mail in Dane or Milwaukee or another county in the state? What are your thoughts about this recount taking place? What are you watching for? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you were at the recount center in Madison earlier today. What was it like there?
So it was a pretty bustling place. I tried to get an estimate from Monona Terrace officials about the number of observers who were there to watch the recount proceedings. They didn't have a concrete number for me, but they said it was at least a couple hundred. And that tracks with what I saw. This was a very different kind of recount than the one I covered in 2016 in Wisconsin. It was in a big kind of, you know, convention center room, long tables with plexiglass barriers between the election workers and the observers. Usually three observers on the one side of the glass and a worker going through ballots on the other side. Everything today for the Dane County recount was done by hand. So a very, you know, kind of low-tech process that you could watch and understand pretty easily as they're holding up ballots, folks that are observing, challenging ballots one by one, those kind of going in another pile. And then we also got some input from the Biden and Trump campaigns as well as kind of the at the outset of this and what they're expecting from it.
You covered, Laurel, a long meeting of the Wisconsin Elections Commission earlier this week, setting up the recount rules, 6+ hours, I think. What came out of that?
So as you know, Rob, the Wisconsin Elections Commission is a bipartisan board. So there are three Democratic appointed members, three Republican appointed members. And as one of the commissioners said at the meeting on Wednesday night, the commission is kind of built for inertia in that they've got to have bipartisan cooperation for anything to move forward. Otherwise, everything kind of deadlocks on 3-3 votes. Things don't move forward. And that's really what we saw on Wednesday night, were commissioners on either side of the aisle not being able to agree on how to guide clerks about how to do this recount. The things that they disagreed about were guidance about taking into account social distancing and COVID-19 procedures and weighing those against, you know, observers' needs and observers being able to get close enough to see, to kind of engage with the process in a way that's satisfying for them to observe the recount. And the other thing was just interpretations of state election laws and how they're going to tell, how they were going to tell clerks to follow state law. So basically what happened is the recount manual that the commission approved that night is by and large the 2018 manual with just a couple little changes because they just couldn't come to an agreement about new guidance to give clerks this year.
Now, the notion here, I think when people think of recounts, Laurel, they're thinking, okay, maybe we can find enough fishy ballots to swing the election. That's a 20,000 vote swing. I don't think anybody thinks that's going to happen one at a time. It sounds like the Trump campaign is charging or is kind of trying to overturn large categories of ballots. What kind of grounds are they using to challenge?
That's absolutely right. So there are kind of three categories of ballots that the Trump campaign is trying to get thrown out. One of those are ballots that have envelopes, absentee ballots that had envelopes on which local election officials added information if the voter forgot to put it there, specifically witness signature information. So on an absentee ballot, you've got to have the voter's name, the voter's signature, a witness's name, and the witness's signature. under policy and guidelines that clerks have been working under for several elections, the past 11 elections actually, clerks can add a witness address if they can get that from a reliable source, like calling the voter or checking state records. The Trump campaign rejects that, and they say any absentee ballot envelope that was altered by a clerk should be thrown out, and of course the ballot that goes with it, right? So that's one category of ballots that they want thrown out. Another category are ballots cast by indefinitely confined voters. The reason they don't like those ballots is you can request an absentee ballot if you're indefinitely confined without meeting the state's voter ID law. They don't like that. And then the third category is a pretty big category of ballots, and those are absentee ballots that there isn't a paper application for the ballot that goes along with it. And that, in that case, those are ballots requested on the MyVote website, which many people were directed to leading up to the election, and also ballots that were cast at in-person early voting locations. Under Elections Commission policy, for quite a while, there aren't paper applications issued to distribute ballots at in-person early voting. So those are the large categories that the Trump campaign is kind of trying to exclude from the recount and change the outcome of the state election.
And the commissioners in these cases rejected those challenges for the count, but that wasn't really the point, is it? It sounds like these are going to be challenged in court ultimately.
That's right. So everybody pretty much agrees that the end game here is going to be the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The Board of Canvassers in both Dane and Milwaukee counties are majority Democrat boards. They both have two Democrats and one Republican. So they are voting to throw out these proposed exclusions by the Trump campaign. They're conducting the recount as they see fit. And then many people believe that when the recount is complete, the Trump campaign will sue and say that the recount wasn't conducted in accordance with law because of these things that they're challenging, and that that would go to the court. And then ultimately the court is going to decide which ballots, if any, should be thrown out.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White covers the state capitol for WPR. We're looking at the recount now in two Wisconsin counties, the two biggest counties, Dane and Milwaukee. Barry Burden joins us now, professor of political science at UW-Madison, director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
It's nice to be back with you.
Well, two counties only, and it sounds like if these things go to court, we could have a situation where we're asking to overturn the votes in two counties for following the same rules that the other 70 counties do? Is that one possible outcome?
It's possible. You know, there's a flashback here to the year 2000 when the election in Florida was held up by recounts and lawsuits. That took over a month and ran right through our Thanksgiving holiday that year as well. And one of the issues in the end for the U.S. Supreme Court was that the Gore campaign had requested recounts in only five counties, I think, out of the 67, I believe, that are in Florida. And so their argument was that voters were being treated unequally because some were subject to a recount and others not, and they put a stop to that. So it does seem like a risky strategy here legally, if this does end up in the courts, to request a recount only in two counties that appear to be targeted, leaving the other 70 without the same treatment.
Now, what do you make of the Trump campaign strategy here, deciding to do this recount, not going for all 72 counties, just the two biggest and most Democratic-leaning counties?
Well, it seems to be a multi-pronged strategy. Some of it is clearly just to cast doubt on the election results and extend the indecisiveness, at least in the mind of some voters, about what has happened, maybe to turn up some other irregularities that it doesn't have awareness of, but things might be revealed in the course of a recount. And that could all be potential material for a lawsuit, whether it's in federal or state court, as Laurel mentioned. The recount itself is not likely to change the outcome of the race in Wisconsin. That's not been the pattern of recounts here or around the country. You know, we did a full recount of the state 4 years ago in Wisconsin. It took a couple of weeks, and it was a hand recount, ballot by ballot, in most of the state. And it ended up changing the balance between Clinton and Trump by only 131 votes when they were separated by a very similar 20,000 to this year. In fact, in the last couple decades, there have only been 3 statewide recounts in any state that have changed the outcome, and all of them were very narrowly decided, typically by just a few hundred votes.
We're talking to political science professor Barry Burden from UW-Madison, looking at the election recount that started today in Dane and Milwaukee counties. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions about this partial recount. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about Wisconsin's partial recount kicking off in 2 counties today with Barry Burden, political scientist at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts about this recount in Milwaukee County and Dane County at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeffrey is with us in De Pere. Jeffrey, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Good evening, gentlemen. First of all, I voted early. And I did it right at City Hall. Secondly, the gentleman you're speaking with mentioned that there was a partial recount 4 years ago. And my initial thought was, not knowing that, or why was it good enough 4 years ago for all the votes to count when now it is not? And then thirdly, I got an email from Robin Voss, the state of Wisconsin, stating the state of Wisconsin has the safest voting system, period. Why isn't Robin Voss speaking up and saying this recount is ridiculous? Thank you. I'll listen offline.
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. To clarify, there was a full recount 4 years ago, not a partial one. The whole state got recounted then. But thanks for calling in, Jeffrey. Jeffrey, raising a concern about challenges to the legitimacy of the election, I think, Barry, and wanting to see more politicians across the board speak up to defend it.
Yeah, I think it's a genuine concern. It's a serious concern. Public opinion surveys are showing, you know, some voters, especially supporters of Donald Trump, are showing less confidence in the election system now that the election has passed. That's a really troubling sign for a democracy that needs to have its constituents believe in the process and abide by the rules. You know, research shows that one of the things that drives down voter confidence is when politicians say they don't have confidence. It becomes a kind of vicious circle where leaders of parties will say they are suspicious or they believe there are irregularities or they have reasons not to trust the outcome. That will cause their followers to also be suspicious and not trust the outcome. And I think it's really essential that elected officials who understand that elections have integrity and are functioning well, and that our election this year in Wisconsin was a success, remind their constituents of that, that this really is a positive story. We ought to be celebrating democracy. And if the recount does anything, hopefully it will convince people who are skeptical that this is a transparent process and that the original count was correct.
Let's go to another caller. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. If I could just address the last issue, I think that logic and reason and the facts don't work on a lot of the Trump supporters, unfortunately. This is what he's doing is the nature of his whole life. He's had a legion of armies all the way going back to when he was a real estate developer and whatever. People have, there's plenty of court records that show when, you know, someone hands him a bill and he says, okay, I'll give you 20% of that, and then you have to sue him. So some plumber or craftsman isn't going to be able to do that. And that's the way that Donald Trump operates. And I think this is a dangerous disgrace to our democracy to imply, when even his own person said it was the safest and most secure election in U.S. history.
Well, I gotcha. Thanks for calling in. To be clear, though, Barry, I mean, a candidate within 1% in Wisconsin who's willing to pony up the cash is legally entitled to ask for a recount, right? That's just part of the system.
Yeah, that's right. In this case, the Trump campaign is entirely following the law and taking advantage of an opportunity. They do have to pay for the recount, and even the selective recount they've chosen to do will cost the campaign about $3 million. But because the margin's less than 1%, it's possible. 4 years ago, it was the Jill Stein campaign that paid for the full statewide recount. The cost was a bit lower then because there weren't pandemic precautions to keep in place, and there were just fewer ballots as well. But she was within her rights to do that then. So it's fine. But, you know, I think this whole set of things that's been happening over the past couple of weeks really is a continuation, as the caller just mentioned, of Trump's assertions about problems with the voting system, his complaints that really go back to the 2016 election, which he won nationally and in Wisconsin, you know, his concerns about non-citizens voting, about dead people voting, about ballots being harvested and photocopied and produced by foreign countries, and other kinds of assertions that are really not based in fact. This recounts a perfectly legal process, but it does feed into that larger narrative that has been a consistent emphasis from Trump over the years.
And that's an important distinction. We've heard from the president. We heard from his team of lawyers yesterday, allegations about vast conspiracies of fraud. Here in this recount, that's not what his campaign is even bringing up here, right? They're not talking about fraud. They're talking about objections to the procedures that we've been using in elections here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, there are a lot of messages out there. And so it's easy, I think, for the average member of the public to get confused about who's saying what. You know, the press conference yesterday involving Rudy Giuliani and other folks in the Republican Party was about voting machines and other concerns. Those are really not an issue in Wisconsin. It's only these two counties. There's no question about the voting machines being raised. It's mainly about absentee ballots, as Laurel described, three or four issues that they're targeting around either in-person early votes, which are a form of absentee voting, or those that were mailed in. So if this is a normal part of the process. I would say also the canvassing that each of the counties did over the past couple of weeks was a normal part of the process. The auditing of voting machines that's taking place now, also a normal part of the process. Even the counting of absentee ballots on election night, all of that is publicly available. People can watch. It's transparent. And this is sort of a normal part of any election.
We'll leave it there. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Barry Burton, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, director there of the Elections Research Center. He joined us today to talk about the partial recount of ballots cast in the 2020 general election. Two counties requested recounts. President Trump and his campaign requested those recounts. It started today here in Wisconsin. Tuesday marked exactly 1 year since the first case of COVID-19 was detected in China. The world has changed dramatically since then. In Wisconsin, on that day, 92 deaths were reported. More than 2,000 were in the hospital. On this somber anniversary, WPR's Bram Sable-Smith went to the COVID unit at the University Hospital in Madison and filed this report.
It's almost remarkable how much of this trip to the hospital feels ordinary. There's a line of cars to get into the garage, where you still have to push a button to get a ticket and enter. There's a bustle of patients coming in and out of the entrance. Everyone is wearing a mask, though, and a screener checks your symptoms as you enter. Three floors up, this COVID unit also feels familiar. In normal times, this is a general care floor of the hospital. But, of course, these are not normal times. The unit was repurposed in March. Each room now has negative air pressure to prevent the coronavirus from spilling into the hallway. And nursing assistant Mary Lowe says recently, all 28 beds in this unit have been consistently full.
I mean, we were always a busy unit, but I definitely see way more days where I feel overwhelmed. There's just so much to do, and the acuity of the patients is pretty high. They need a lot of care.
Lowe's work brings her in direct contact with 7 or 8 COVID patients a day. She helps them with everything from eating, using the restroom, and bathing. But like the calm at the eye of a hurricane, she feels safer here than some places outside the hospital.
Knowing exactly what I'm dealing with and who has it and who doesn't than I would if I were working at a grocery store right now and not knowing who I'm coming in contact with.
The medical staff in the hallway are wearing surgical masks, but they suit up in protective gear before they enter patient rooms. Gown, gloves, and protection for the face. Recently, Lowe says she's transitioned from using an N95 and face shield to using a device called a PAPR. It's almost like a soft astronaut's helmet connected to an air filter.
I really like that I can smile at patients and they can see my face, or if we have a deaf patient that can read lips, then they can still have the ability to do that as well.
The most serious COVID patients, the ones who are unconscious and on a ventilator, are in one of the 4 other COVID units at this hospital. The patients here are conscious, usually getting oxygen, steroids, and personal care. With basically no visitors allowed, Lo often finds herself providing emotional support. The hardest for her is when a patient leaves this unit for more intensive care. Those are the ones who sometimes don't recover.
It's definitely hard. Patients are suffering, and, you know, people are really sick here. We're all working really hard to help them get better and to support them, but it's definitely straining us.
This is why the hospital has started granting access to its COVID units, why Mary Lo is taking time out of her 12-hour shift to talk to a reporter. Treating COVID patients is exhausting. They've been doing it for months. And Dr. Ann Sheehy notes, even with promising news about vaccines, there's no end in sight for healthcare workers.
Our hospitalization rate continues to look like a mountain, and we're still climbing that mountain. We really need help from the people of Wisconsin to help us shut this down.
As a division head, Sheehy helps with the staffing logistics of caring for COVID-19. It's not easy.
Everybody's working a lot of extra hours to take really good care of these patients. And I think, if anything, I mean, this is a group that's really driven to take good care of patients, and people will continue to go above and beyond until they just can't.
And that's what she wants you to know. The doctors and nurses and everyone on staff at this hospital are working hard to keep people in Wisconsin alive during this pandemic. But at a certain point, there's only so much they can do. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes from a reporting partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up, we'll learn about another divide here in American politics. We know about the partisan gap between Democrats and Republicans. Our guest says there's also an attention divide between people who follow politics super closely and people who really don't. And that does make a difference. Stick around. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, holiday decorations hit the shelves of stores earlier each year. This year, many people are choosing to decorate extra early to bring a little joy. If that's you, we want to hear from you. Now, according to new research, there's a huge clash in America's political landscape, and I'm not talking about the one between Republicans and Democrats. A pair of political science professors from Stony Brook University in New York found that the vast majority of Americans, about 80 to 85%, say they follow politics casually or not at all. Only 15 to 20% say they follow it closely. And those camps have different ideas about which issues are most important. And there might be more shared values among Americans than we might think. Yana Krupnikov is an associate professor of political science at Stony Brook University. She's a co-author, along with her colleague John Barry Ryan, of a forthcoming book about polarization and disengagement in American politics. Yana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's interesting. From my perspective, the people I hear from, either as guests on the show or callers from the show, they are very engaged in following politics. It sounds like from your research, they are not the norm. Tell us about the people, what most people are doing when it comes to politics.
Yeah, so it absolutely makes sense that the people you would hear from on the show and your guest would in fact be the people for whom politics matters a lot. They're the people who are on social media. They're the people who are kind of reading the news every day, and there's so much news to read. But our research suggests that for a lot of Americans, on average about 80%, that's not something that's happening. Now, these people know about the election. Mm-hmm. They know things that have been happening after the election. They might have been really excited to vote. They might have cared a lot. They're not necessarily following all the political details. They're not necessarily going on social media. They're not necessarily talking about politics all that much.
This might not matter, except that, again, from your research, it's, and others, it sounds like these 80% of people don't necessarily look at politics the same way the more engaged partisans do. And even, you know, the Democrats who don't pay attention as much aren't the same as Democrats who do. Same for Republicans. Why is this group of people different?
Well, they're different in a number of ways. So first, I think what's really important about them is that they have different issue positions. So they actually care about different things. People who care about politics a lot, for whom politics is very, very, very important, have this set of issues that are in some sense more ideological. Now, the other 80%, the ones who are voting but aren't paying quite as much attention to the day-to-day details, care about things like wages, for example. And so what we're seeing is that within parties, so within Democrats and within Republicans, there are these gaps between the 20% who pay a ton of attention and the 80% who aren't quite as involved. And so, of course, the implications here are, who are we listening to? Who has the most voice in American politics? Because that's going to affect representation.
Who does have the most voice in American politics?
Well, that's an interesting question, right? On the one hand, we can think of people who turn out to vote as having voice. People who waited for hours to turn out, sometimes in states that made it very difficult for them to vote, made their voices heard in that way. But we can think of voice in another way as well. When journalists report on politics, who are they covering? When somebody takes to Twitter to make their political opinion heard, whose opinion is actually going to end up in media coverage? And more likely than not, kind of these examples of politics, these people whose social media opinions are going to get picked up, are the people who are really, really, really involved in politics. So when somebody checks the news, when somebody reads about partisan politics, the images they're seeing are the images of people who care the most, who also happen to be the most ardent partisans. So when we think about politics, we think of the people who are most involved rather than the 80% who have genuine political preferences, but just maybe less likely to express them.
If I'm one of those people who's, you know, not paying as close attention to politics, it doesn't mean I'm not, you know, maybe on one side or another. It doesn't mean I'm a moderate. But through my eyes, what do those more extreme groups that are heavily represented in our media and politics, what do they look like to me as far as what we know from the people in that category?
Well, we've done some research on this. And what those people look like is, first, they look like people who talk a lot about politics. In fact, when people think about partisans, the images that come to their minds are people who basically are endlessly discussing political topics. The second thing is that they look like people who are extraordinarily ideological. So they look like somebody who has very extreme opinions. They look like somebody who is on kind of the tail ends of the Democratic and Republican parties. And so even if almost everyone you encounter in your actual day-to-day lives isn't really talking about politics that much, they're not posting about politics on social media, they have qualms about maybe both parties, when you imagine a partisan, you're imagining the partisans on your television, right? The people who are basically on the screen saying that, you know, they're not going to accept the election no matter what, for example, on the Republican side. Because these people often get the interviews, that's who ends up coming to mind when we think about political outcomes.
We're talking to Yana Krupnikov from Stony Brook University. She's co-author of a piece on how much attention we pay to American politics, a big divide between partisans on both sides who spend a lot of time eating, drinking, and breathing politics, and the majority who have a more passing and distant and maybe healthy interest in the way they view politics. Yana, what do you think of that idea? It sounds kind of nice taking a break from watching politics all the time. I can't do it. You can't do it. But it sounds kind of nice, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah, there are certainly times when I wish I could do it. And then I remember my job. In that sense, right, I think it's important to remember that for a lot of people, politics is not going to come up into their day-to-day lives. They're not going to see it on their social media feeds. They're not necessarily going to talk about it with their family members. They're not necessarily going to talk about it with their friends. Those people who are going to talk about it are going to talk about it a lot. They're going to follow it very closely. Is this healthy? It kind of depends, right? On the one hand, we need these people who are deeply engaged in politics to in some sense, pull fire alarms for us, right? To say, like, now we got to pay extra attention. On the other hand, there is a tremendous sense of anxiety that goes into these people's day-to-day lives. Following politics on a minute-by-minute basis is immensely stressful. It is anxiety-provoking. And the flip side of that is that it's also anxiety provoking when you can't follow politics because you imagine that something must be happening. So politics means a lot of anxiety for a lot of people.
We talked about how the people who pay more attention and end up being more ideological and partisan are often overrepresented in the media. How about for politicians? If I'm a member of Congress, say, which I'm not and I won't be, but if I were, there's a lot of people out there posting daily, writing me, maybe even calling my office, analyzing my every move on my own side. And then there's a big group who aren't doing that. Their views are different. Am I going to be skewed? Am I going to be pushed in a direction just based on that overrepresentation of this 15-20% of my constituents?
I think there is some danger of that. If we think about the way that people gather information, there is the possibility that we start to treat the information that is most readily available to us, which is the opinions of people who care the most, as the indication of how everyone feels. And so you start to imagine that these people who are the most vocal, who are the loudest, who kind of talk about politics the most, that they are actually speaking for everyone else. And once you imagine that, there is the chance that you end up trying to represent these views, not actually realizing that they are perhaps different from the remainder of your constituents.
So supposing we agree that this is a problem, how can we in the media and I guess political parties and political representatives make sure that they don't ignore this large majority of people who maybe aren't speaking as loudly on a day-to-day basis?
Well, first of all, you know, I want to say that I think a lot of journalists have done a fairly tremendous job covering an immensely difficult time in American politics. So I think a lot of journalists are, in fact, very much mindful of these differences in public opinion. Now, I think another thing that you kind of have to think about is that the people who are most extreme, who are most vocal, are the ones who sometimes make for the best story. They're the ones that are going to give the quote that is most interesting. And so I think one thing to remember is in kind of looking for this personalization and looking for these examples, that they might not necessarily speak to the bulk of political voices. And another thing I think to remember is that in giving somebody a platform, they're in fact being elevated, right? They're now speaking and representing a group of people who may not necessarily be pleased with their representation. In fact, I'm part of a group of political scientists who kind of has suggested some points for journalists in covering elections. And one of the ideas is not to elevate voices who are extreme. We hear about these extreme people and the tendencies to exemplify them through a particular person, because that is more interesting than just covering polling data. But I think it's important to remember that in covering that extreme voice, you've now given it a much larger platform than this voice would have had otherwise.
Yana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yana Krupnikov is an associate professor of political science at Stony Brook University. She's co-author of a forthcoming book about polarization and disengagement in American politics. We talked with her about what she calls America's attention divide between those who follow politics casually at most and those who follow it closely. Coming up, we've seen some anecdotal evidence that people are putting up holiday decorations earlier than usual this year, and we're going to want to hear from you. Do you have your Christmas lights up? Have you decorated for the holidays indoors and or outdoors? Is it earlier than usual for you. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know what you've got going on and what you're seeing in your own neighborhood. We'll take your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, join Jen White for a roundup of some of the big stories of the week, including a drawdown plan for U.S. troops in Afghanistan. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the age-old question, when is it the right time to put up your Christmas lights or other holiday decorations? If you've put yours up already or you're getting ready to do it maybe this weekend, we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, psychologists say that for some people, decorating can produce a difference, a good difference in mood. It can boost happiness, which might be why some people, at least looking around, seem to have had theirs up for a couple few weeks now. That includes Wisconsin-based author BJ Hollers, who explains why his household decorated for Christmas on November 1st this year in this video for Volume 1, a magazine based in Eau Claire.
We all have our coping mechanisms, and perhaps mine is the oddest of all. Stringing so many lights around the Christmas tree that its brightness rivals the sun. Yet we all do what we can because doing something feels better than the alternative. This year, my one and only Christmas wish is that by this holiday season, the world seems a whole lot brighter. May we all find light wherever we can. In the glow of a menorah or Kwanzaa candles, or the inflatable Frosty taking up residence in our lawn.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are your lights up yet? Are they about to go up? Have you done it early? Are you enjoying seeing other people's decorations up, maybe earlier than usual? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And let's go to your calls now. Janine starts us off in Sebula, Iowa. Am I saying it right, Janine?
Yeah, Sebula.
Sebula, great. I know all the Wisconsin ones. Iowa, I'm not rock solid on. What did you want to tell us about, Janine?
I was like, that is me. Like, this year I did it early. I started at the 1st of October, but then every week there was like something else I needed because I haven't had Christmas at my house for probably 12 years. There's, you know, I go to families for Christmas or for Thanksgiving. My kids go with their dad, and I usually go to family away. And then we all go there at the same time. And they're not this year. It got canceled because of COVID. And I was kind of depressed because it's hard since my mom passed, you know.
Sure.
And I thought, you know what? I'm going to put the Christmas tree up. I'm going to put lights on it. I haven't done it forever. So the kids thought I was kind of crazy. They're like, Mom, what are you dealing with all that? You're taking that all out. I don't want to help you put it away. No, you will. But I said, I'm doing it to cheer myself up, you know.
Was it working, Janine? Or do you feel cheerier?
Yeah, I was just going to say it. And I got to say, it's worked a little bit.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm glad it's helping perk you up. And thanks for sharing your story, Janine, at 800-642-1234. Andrew joins us next in Muskego. Andrew, hi.
Good evening. Yeah, I put my lights up begrudgingly. the better half and her son love the holidays. So they said, just put them up. It's 70 degrees out. And I fought tooth and nail, and I said, you know what? I'm going to ask my Facebook friends. So I asked them, and they all ganged up on me and said, put them up as well. So I got them all up, and it looks like the Griswolds moved into our house, and they're up, but they are not on. I'm putting my foot down. I will not turn them on until the day after Thanksgiving.
Well, wait. What's the point in having them up if you're not turning the lights on after it gets dark, Andrew? Come on.
Because the turkey needs his day.
All right. Okay, you don't want to crowd out Thanksgiving. I respect that, Andrew. Thank you so much. Well, Andrew gave in to the mandates of his household and Facebook community. How about you? We're asking you if you are putting up your holiday decorations, keep doing that, early this year. If you've already done it, you're getting ready to do it this weekend. If you're seeing lots of them, call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. We have just an incredible variety of different lights up this year. There are Christmas lights up. I can see trees up in people's houses with all the decorations, lights and everything. But we also have turkeys. We have orange lights. I don't know if that's Thanksgiving or Halloween. I still have my pumpkins up. We have one house has their decorations are they look like palm trees the way they're set up. So we've got it all. We did have one year, not this year, I don't think, but somebody got the great idea to hook up their tree decoration outside to the agitator from a wash machine. But it didn't last very long. I think the tree kind of got beat up.
Yeah, that's rough on a tree. Susie, thanks. Sounds like you got a lively neighborhood. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Eau Claire now. Joe is there. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, we've got we've had them up for probably 2 or 3 weeks already. We don't have the indoor lights up on the tree, but we do have the outdoor lights all up. We did that for a couple reasons. Number one, it's a great activity being outside. We have young children, you know, being able to be outside and get that fresh air. And with everything going on with COVID, it's a safe activity to do. Number two, we did it because we were worried that there could be maybe a shortage. If we were to need more lights coming up, there's been kind of a shortage of supplies due to COVID. So we thought if we got our lights up earlier, we'd have a better chance of getting replacement lights if we needed to by doing it earlier. So,
did you need a lot of replacements, Joe, or did everything work pretty well?
You know what? We had some of those really frustrating ones where half the strand worked.
Yep.
Which you know, that's really frustrating because then you have to, like, pull out the fuses and it still doesn't work. But we do have little kids and we do make the drive around, you know, the neighborhoods, and they like to see the other lights. And I think that once you have kids that appreciate the other lights, as a parent, you want to be the house that other kids can come appreciate as well. So it's a community event, really, when it comes down to it, I think. So
that's a great way to think about it. Joe, thanks for calling in. We're asking if you've decorated yet, if you have lights outside, maybe earlier than usual this year. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Leighton joins us next in Nisita. Leighton, hi. Nope, Leighton's not there. Well, you can join in, 800-642-1234. We got an email from Anne in Madison. Anne says she used to prefer doing it after Thanksgiving for Christmas decorations. This COVID year, one of the few safe things she can do is walking around her neighborhood. She says, now that the flowers are gone and birds are scarce, I really appreciate the decorations. Lots of trees inside and lights outside, all twinkling in the darkness, and many tinsel-covered decorations sparkling in the daylight. Thank you to the decorators. You really lift spirits during this stressful time. It's like a song in there, I think. But thank you, Anne. A good description of what's going on there. Thank you so much for sharing that. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR to let us know if you've got lights up. I know our own Bill Martin's producer said he's got his lights on outside, I think he said, not inside. But I'm sure he'll get those up pretty soon. How about you? 800-642-1234. Deborah is with us now in Lafarge. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I put my lights up the day the election was called. My lights are purple. I had to stand in the bucket of the tractor to get up as high as I needed to. But purple is red and blue. And so I put them up for healing and conciliation in our country. Thank you.
That sounds great. And using the tractor to do it, I love it. Deborah, thanks for calling in. I think we have time for one more caller, if we can get him queued up real quick. Do we have Leighton ready? Leighton is back. Leighton and Nisita. Hi, Leighton.
Hey.
What do you want to tell us about?
Hi there. Well, I'm calling because I have definitely had my lights up since Halloween.
Wow.
Seeing as Thanksgiving is a boring holiday, and I'm ready for Christmas.
Awesome. Fighting words for some people, including one of our earlier callers, Leighton. Thank you so much for calling in. Up since just after Halloween. Well, you could keep sharing your stories. And, hey, maybe send us some pictures. Email your favorite holiday setup in your neighborhood. Maybe it's your own. ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us see what you have going on there. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7, Governor Evers met with Republican leaders in the state legislature for the first time in a long time. Kate and her guests look at the prospects for common ground on dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic here in the state. That's Monday at 7 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we're 1 week out from Black Friday, but holiday shopping is looking a lot different this year. We'll talk with a retail expert about how stores are changing things up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.